Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Thanks for that little theological interlude. I always love taking these to the, you know, boots on the ground kind of stuff in our congregations. But let's get back to the story. Where we basically left off last time we were in this was in Genesis 3. Adam and Eve, we had the temptation. We had a little interlude about Satan and if the snake and Satan is really a connection that at least the biblical writers made. Then we talked a little bit about naked and ashamed, and we're now about to get to the consequences of partaking of the fruit and God's responses. So, David, if you can just kind of catch us right in, you know, context or whatever we need to, and just start leading us in that story part.
So in our last discussion, we learned that the man and the woman in Eden partake of a fruit that is described textually as having a quality that will give a knowledge of what in Hebrew appears as tov varah, which is translated in the King James Version as good and evil. And as we discussed, Dan, a lot of interpreters render that as a type of merismus or polar expression. That's a technical term where two opposite words denote all or every. A comparison from the New Testament would be Alpha and Omega, the first letter of the Greek alphabet and the last letter of the Greek alphabet. Jesus Christ is everything to us all. His atonement provides life to all things. So, and what I suggested in our previous discussion was that in reality, at least from my perspective, that expression should not denote all knowledge, but really specifically a sexual awareness. And if the author of that particular text, I would argue, intended the fruit to represent a type of etiology or story of origin for the advancement of all things pertaining to human culture, rather than an allusion to specifically sexual awareness, then surely the fruit would have immediately provided the humans with an understanding of how to produce clothing, because they had gained a knowledge of all things. Do you see the logic?
Interesting.
So they don't have that knowledge. Yahweh has to step forward and make the textiles or the clothing for them, so they don't know all things. And this reflects the fact that in this documentary source tradition that, again, we'll call J, the story of prehistory that runs from Genesis 1 through 11 typically places considerable emphasis upon what we might deem the cultural hero motif. So, for example, we're going to get to Cain and Abel shortly, and Cain and Abel appear as types of cultural heroes in that they start to farm and herd in Genesis 4:2. It's the origin of this, at least in terms of the story's viewpoint. Cain appears celebrated then afterwards as the builder of the first human city. We see that in chapter 4, verse 17, as I look at the text. And we see Yabal, another great patriarchal figure in this account. He originates the cultural traditions of tent dwelling and cattle raising in verse 20, in chapter 4, verse 20. And Yabal appears as the father of every player of lyre and pipe in the subsequent verse. And then Tubal Cain appears as the original forger of tools made of bronze and iron in 422. And if we continue this, even Noah appears celebrated in J as the cultural hero who introduces humanity to production of wine and vineyards, which will be important in terms of how Noah will help eradicate this curse we'll see shortly that God places upon the earth because of what the man does in terms of consuming the fruit. So what I'm arguing here is that despite the text's interest in identifying cultural heroes in prehistory, the first man and woman in Eden are only credited with introducing intelligent sex. Well, and of course, pain and farming and pregnancy. But
right.
in other words, if a knowledge of good and bad really signified, as some have argued, a totality of human knowledge, then presumably the author would have taken advantage of the opportunity to associate the development of cultural skills with the first humans who acquired such wisdom. But instead, all we see, Dan, is that the only explicit contribution that the text attributes to the first humans is in fact sexual awareness, and they exercise that immediately in chapter 4, verse 1. So that deals a lot with my own personal approach to this text and how I see it and what I see in terms of its meaning. And that leads nicely into, I believe, where you wanted to go in terms of the curse that is left upon the man, the woman, the serpent, and the earth.
And also, is there anything in the conversation like, what is it that you did? Well, you know, the woman that you gave to me. I mean, if there's anything in that section too, we probably ought to pick that up as well.
Okay.
And either Tom, are you good with where David is so far?
Yes, exactly. Because one of the things I believe that our Christian communities would do well to understand is the end of chapter 3 is a covenantal curse. It's not, you know, what Augustine, you know, called a total corruption, you know, of the spirit of human beings based on Genesis 5:3, as he used. And I do agree the term yada is very important, isn't it, in understanding the type of awareness that they had, because they imaged God, number one. Number two, it is their identity that I believe the Lord is talking about in this sexual awareness.
That's very nice. Yes, the yada, to know, which is the root of knowledge, is used as a type of evasive term or euphemism for specifically sexual activity. We'll see that as we transition out of Eden. The first time that the man and the woman exercise the ability to know is in the production of offspring in Cain in chapter 4, verse 1. So I agree with you, Tom. It seems to be pointed to that, and that's why I find it so exciting that the text, the serpent specifically states, you will come to know, meaning having sexual knowledge, like the Elohim, like the gods, suggesting that the gods themselves have the same type of sexual awareness that we see in other ancient Near Eastern mythology and constructs.
Great. Take us with the story, David, wherever you want to go in terms of either the exchange with Adam and Eve on the why are you hiding yourself and all that stuff, okay, and the man and the woman, or just keep going down to the curses themselves.
Okay, sure. So the account, again, this is an account where God is so anthropomorphic and human. We find him walking around in the cool of the day in chapter 3, verse 8, to keep from getting too warm and hot. And then he calls out to the man in verse 9. The man, it's not Adam in this account, as we discussed last time. He's described as the man, specifically, the human being. And he said, well, where are you? And then he replies, well, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and so I hid. And then he asked, well, who told you? How'd you get this information? And then he does point to the woman. The man said, the woman you put at my side, she gave me of the tree. I ate that fruit that you told me I shouldn't eat. Right? And then Yahweh says to the woman, well, what is it that you've done? And that's interesting, Dan, because a lot of readers don't recognize that, at least textually, the woman is not yet created. She's not even present in the text, narratively speaking, when Yahweh gives the man the command, right?
He
gives
him,
don't eat from the fruit of knowledge, of good and evil. Then he creates the, because you'll become like the gods, is the implication, and Yahweh doesn't want that to happen at this point. And then he creates the animals, then he creates the woman. So she's not even there, which is interesting.
Yes.
But still, yes, he points to her, and then she says, well, there's that King James term, beguiled. He fooled, me at some sort, the serpent that talked to me. And then the curses begin.
Now, one thing before you go there, is Adam passing the buck, or is he just stating something factually?
Yeah, it's a good question, Dan. Tom, what do you think? How would you read that?
Yeah, restate the question again.
Speaking of passing the buck. Sorry, go ahead.
Funny. yeah. No, Tom, I was basically saying, when Adam says, God says to Adam, where the heck are you? You know, I heard you, I was hiding, and who told you that I was naked? And then he begins, and he immediately says, the woman thou gavest me, she's the one who, you know.
That's right. It says, thou did hearken to the voice of your wife.
Right. So are we basically saying, is Adam being a wimp here and like passing the blame on to her, or is he simply stating the facts? Well, here's the sequence of events.
Yeah, it sounds like he's passing the buck, doesn't it? I believe even the Doctrine and Covenants expands on that a little bit. I believe there's a statement in there that says, what has thou done?
Yeah.
Oh, heavens to Murgatroyd. Yeah, and then, of course, we find in 2 Timothy 2, you know, in the New Testament, where it talks about who was complicit and who deceived who. You know, as Paul puts a different interpretation on it. But it sounds like to me they both knew what they were doing, right? Because she gave, and they both ate. So they both partook of it, even though they were both told not to. So it sounds like they're both culpable.
Yeah, no doubt. And Tom, it brings up a good point, and that is the development of later Christian and Jewish traditions that you have to kind of strip apart. I mean, it's important to understand how later interpreters, whether we're talking DNC or Augustine or whomever, or Paul for that matter, how they interpret it is perhaps a little bit of an expansion and maybe beyond what the original author.
What's in the immediate text, isn't it? It's not always in the later revelation.
Yeah.
Or commentaries.
Okay, so we'll leave that as an open question, but you guys think that it's... Yeah, it's kind of a little bit wimpy on Adam's part, at least according to the author.
Yeah, but I mean, but at the same time, he is really stating the facts. Look, she gave it to me, because the account, at least as read, we don't even read that that she explains to him what she's going to give him to eat, right?
Right. You get more in the temple ceremony, and one interesting thing in the temple ceremony versus that account, you know, the serpent goes to Adam first.
Yeah.
You know, as well,
yeah.
But here, the serpent's only hanging out with Eve and never approaches Adam.
So these are, again, expansions that we see that add on to it and give it a different spin that we see specifically in the text itself. So
yeah, because he gave to her, right? And she did eat.
Yeah. But at least in the text, there's no indication, at least I can see, that he would have even known, really, what he was eating. She just gives it to him, and he eats, and he's like, whoa, look at you.
You've got parts.
Sounds like that, doesn't it? Yeah.
It does.
It sounds like Adam, or the man, was caught a little by surprise.
Now, the one thing that is in Adam's response to God that is not in the text in Genesis, but that is in the Mormon expansions, is the woman thou gave me and commanded that I stick with her, or that we
mm-hmm.
stick together. That little extra there kind of puts it to like, okay, I definitely have knowledge of this because now I really see this is another one of those two commandment type things, multiply and replenish, but I can't, you know, take the tree that would, you know, give me that knowledge. Here's another thing is like, well, you did command me to be with her. So that's a second kind of tension for him.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of Christian commentators through the centuries have said the man didn't want to be alone, you know, so he went with Eve in the deception, and great enlargements, you know, have been created on that. And of course, the feminists take it in their directions, you know, that Adam was really to blame.
Oh, interesting on that. But it's good to know that besides the Mormons, lots of others are expanding in that same way there. So
that's neat.
Okay, so David, back to where you want to go. Sorry.
No. That's a great discussion there. I think it's very helpful. So then at that stage, then the Lord steps forward and he turns to the snake and he says, "All right, what have you done here? And then you're gonna have a consequence for this." And the curse then is identified in verse 14, because you did this, because you told the woman to eat this fruit, more cursed shall you be than all cattle and all the wild beasts, all the other creatures in the garden. On your belly shall you crawl, and dirt shall you eat all the days of your life. And there's an interesting literary play there, because it's as if this God is stating to the serpent, because you had Adam and Eve, or excuse me, the man and the woman, eat fruit, now you will eat dirt.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it's a nice little literary play, I think, happening in the text from that angle. And then we read, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and hers. And then it describes, you know, what the relationship between snakes in the Middle East and humans. They reach up, they bite the heel of the human and cause pain, if not death, and the human then has the ability to crush its head. So again, this pointing towards an etiology and explanation of how the world order came to be. We transition there to the curse upon the woman, who's, it doesn't say she's going to have a specific curse, but at more of just almost a consequence of what's going to transpire, because the term curse isn't even used here. It states, I will make, and it's really interesting that the verbiage there, it's Yahweh personally is going to personally be involved on some procreative level of what's transpiring in the production of human life. And that ties into where we can go with Genesis 4:1, where the woman's going to step forward and state, I have created a man with Yahweh. So his personal,
okay.
Yeah, his personal role, I, God, will make most severe your pangs in childbearing. In pain shall you bear children. And then, Dan, there's this interesting grammatical transition that happens in biblical Hebrew. It's just a single prefix letter that is attached to the term known as a vav, which is a conjunction. But the conjunction and can be either a conjunction, meaning and your urge shall be to your husband, or it actually can function grammatically as a disjunctive. And it seems to me contextually we'd have to go with disjunctive. So instead of translating it as in pain shall you bear you bear children, and your urge or your sexual desire shall be for your husband, it's really you're not going to be able to escape this. You're going to have an incredible amount of pain in terms of bringing children into the world. And yet, even though you cannot avoid it, still, your sexual urge and passion is going to be for your husband. So you're not going to be able to avoid this situation. And then the statement, and he shall rule over you. So this is really a description of what happens in terms of human society from the author's perspective. Women have incredibly, prior to the days of epidurals, right? They had incredibly painful pregnancies and labors, and they bring children into the world, and it's an incredibly dangerous, life-threatening circumstance. So you could see the author sitting there thinking, well, why do women choose to do this? Why don't, not only that, but then they live in a situation where it's such a patriarchal society that men literally do rule over the women and they have no right. They're treated as second-class citizens. Why don't they just avoid marriage and go form some order of women where they just live off by themselves? Well, the answer is that because you have this sexual knowledge, your sexual urge will be to your husband, so you're not going to be able to escape this curse that is now a result of eating the fruit.
That's a fascinating context.
Yeah.
And it is truly the world, isn't it, order, that the writers of Genesis are trying to say existed at the time, and this is how it functioned.
Yeah, and I wouldn't necessarily read it, therefore, as stating from a theological perspective that this is the way that it should be, that men should rule and have dominion over their wives. I don't believe the text is taking us from that angle or perspective. In reality, what the author is doing is simply, it's descriptive.
Right?
This is the way it really is, and therefore, let me explain how this situation came to be.
Right.
Well, in Genesis 4, verse 1, some of us feel that the translations who say, by the help of the Lord, for kenete ish, at Yahweh, would be better translated, what, I have gotten a man or a child from God, rather than from the help of the Lord, which some of the RSV and the American Standard and other translations kind of add there. And then we look in the Septuagint, and the word dia is used in Greek, you know, to show that it goes through the generations. David, do you agree with my observation that the English translation has weakened a little bit, especially for at Yahweh, by adding English words to the phrase?
Yes, I definitely do. And as I shared last time, I had an opportunity at the beginning of the year to publish an article through Vetus Testamentum. It's entitled, Did Eve Acquire, Create, or Procreate with Yahweh? A Grammatical and Contextual Reassessment of Kana in Genesis 4:1. And so that's, I agree with you, Tom. It definitely, that, again, to help our listeners understand the, what you were talking about in terms of the Hebrew, Tom's referring to this idea of whatever kana means, whether it means to create, to acquire, to procreate even, it is done specifically with Yahweh. Yahweh is actively involved with the process. And I would then argue, and I do in the article, that kana does mean to procreate specifically. It's not even to create, but Yahweh is involved. And that doesn't mean sexual copulation. There's a difference between copulation and procreation. Yahweh is involved with the procreative aspect of helping this life come to be in a mysterious way that the author certainly couldn't understand, and really neither do we, but he's involved with the procreation and directly. He's not just an instrument with, but he's an instrument, a tool.
Yeah, but he's also, instead of just this being the conditions of life that women have pain in childbirth and yet they still seem to have desire for them, this is, at least according to this author, this was God's choosing it, God's doing it, you know, all that stuff. So am I right? We're starting to fade away from that, I think, in our conversation.
I don't know about that, Dan. I think that, you know, it kind of ties back to creation ex nihilo in the sense. We view God as this omnipotent power that has all control over how things transpire.
We do? I don't think Mormons do.
Well, I'm saying as Westerners, perhaps.
Okay.
But in reality, I think to some extent, I would agree with you, that's not fundamental to Mormonism, but we're still influenced by that assumption to some extent. It's in the back of our minds, I think. But in reality, you know, you're right. In Mormonism and even in the text viewpoint, as we discussed last time, this is God giving order to the chaos in creation, and there are some things that are just kind of beyond him. And this means, at least as I would read this text, this is more Yahweh saying, don't eat this fruit, because then you're going to have a sexual awareness like the gods, and it's going to change everything. And he really wants them to stay in the garden, continue to help with the agricultural labors that he has going on there. Work his garden, just like the human beings do in Mesopotamian mythology.
And doesn't it also show us theologically that human beings can thwart or get away from the plan of God, and God has to step in and recorrect it later?
Sure, and so when I at least how I read that curse statement, it's more of a descriptive statement on the part
right.
of Yahweh. Look, this is the result of this. It's not necessarily his will or his desire. Or
well,
fashion,
yes, it is. Isn't he, like you said, I'm going to get involved in this pain in childbearing. It's not like, it doesn't sound like I'm going to strengthen you in this. It's like I'm getting involved. I'm adding some crap to you.
Yeah, maybe so. I guess I could see it from that perspective. No, I hear you. What you're saying, as long as we're able to preserve that construct of this is descriptive of what's going to transpire, and then to the extent of trying to provide to psychoanalyze Yahweh,
or the J writer,
you can see the description of it in chapter 4, verse 3, very clearly. Cain brought to the Lord an offering and fruit of the ground. And it's just telling us what happened, isn't it? And that Abel was a keeper of sheep and Cain was a tiller of the ground. So it's just a story in narrative form, isn't it?
Yeah. So what exactly? And what I guess what I hear you saying, Dan, is that since Yahweh is so personal, I will make most severe your pain, since he's involved with this personally. That he's taking some sort of, I don't know, pleasure maybe.
He's still ticked at this point. He hasn't repented yet, of all of his stuff, like we talked about earlier.
So, in other words, he's angry, and this is, they're going to, so he's going to be involved with helping to produce the pain that this woman is going to experience. Is that what you're saying?
All I'm saying is that seems a piece that I thought you were introducing a little earlier that we're starting to do before. I'm totally comfortable with all this being descriptive because I don't like the idea of God cursing us. And, you know,
yeah.
I'm much more like the natural processes are this, and there's an early person describing these things. So I'm good with that, but it does seem interesting.
Yeah, no, and so am I. And so that's what we have to try to be careful in that we don't impose, and perhaps I'm doing it to some extent, because we all do, right? We tend to impose our own preferences upon the text rather than taking a critical view, which is what we try to avoid as biblical scholars. So it's a very good question.
Well, cool. So now we have this, all of a sudden she is going to be, oh, wait, we haven't had Adam's cursing yet, so go for it.
Yes. Yes, we need to get to this. This is so very important. So to the man then in verse 17, he's going to say, because you did as your wife said and ate of the tree about which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed be the ground. And now this is where it becomes very important. If we're going to understand chapter 4 and the sacrifices that are presented by Cain and Abel, we have to get the grammar right in this. And unfortunately, the King James, I'm not going to say the King James gets it wrong, but I'll say because it's ambiguous in the King James text, I think that we as Latter-day Saint interpreters, we get it wrong when we read it. Because the text states, cursed be the ground, and in King James we read, for your sake.
Right.
And we interpret that as for your benefit, right? That by toil shall you eat from the ground all the days of your life, thorns, thistles shall it sprout for you. And we think, oh, and that's a good thing. It's for your sake. It's for your benefit, in other words, because now you're going to have this opportunity to actually work for a living. And that's a good thing. And that's certainly not what the text is doing. In fact, I guess I can actually see now, Dan, what you're talking about in terms of that Yahweh is upset. He's angry. And so this seems to continue it, and it's almost a, look, yes, it's descriptive, but at the same time, it's like, and here's what's going to happen to you, darn it. I'm so frustrated. I'm ticked off at this, that you did it. So you're going to have toil, and you're going to have thorns and thistles, and your food shall be the grasses of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you're going to eat bread until you return to the ground. For from it you were taken, from dust you are, and to dust you shall return. It is angry. It is definitely angry. I would agree with you. And then, but when I'm going back to that statement, so it's not for your sake in terms of for your benefit. Really, the language is cursed be the ground because of you. So the ground has been cursed. It's been affected because of what the man did. And therefore, what we're going to see transpire in terms of chapter 4, this is going to help us understand why Yahweh won't accept the offering that Cain presents, right? Because Cain is going to bring, and we read in chapter 4, verse 3, an offering to the Lord from the fruit of the ground. Therefore, Cain's offering, by extension, is an accursed thing. Therefore, God is not going to want to consume it and partake of it. But Abel is instead, in chapter 4, verse 4, he's going to bring the choicest of the firstling of the flocks, and Yahweh is going to accept that because the animals, although originally taken from the ground, do not have the same curse placed upon them. Even, you know, Yahweh made that very specific in terms of the serpent is cursed above all other beasts, but the beasts aren't cursed, even though they originally created from the ground. So this explains, if we understand it, why Yahweh, because so many readers have wondered, why doesn't Yahweh accept what Cain has to do? And, of course, the book of Moses adds on and talks about the oaths with Satan and the covenants that Cain made to get his brother's possessions. These are wonderful, wonderful narratives, but it's certainly beyond what the text we have in Genesis presents. From Genesis' perspective, it's just if we follow it synchronically from Genesis 3 into Genesis 4, the whole reason that God rejects Cain offering is because he's presenting an accursed thing. Something comes from the ground that is cursed because of what the man did.
Because in a covenantal curse, everything from the ground would also be cursed, wouldn't it? The thistles,
yes.
And whatever you would give to Yahweh.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So then what about verses 6 and 7, you know, when the Lord, why are you angry? Why is your countenance following? If you'll do well, you'll, you know, I'll accept this. So has he ever given Cain a clue as to how he can redeem this stuff that comes from the ground?
I don't think so. Let's look at 6 and 7. And the Lord said to Cain, why are you upset? Why are you distressed? Why is your face fallen? And this is an interesting, the verb to fall is nafal in Hebrew, and it's the root that links ultimately Cain to some extent with the Nephilim that we're going to talk about shortly, I would assume, in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, who are the offspring that are produced because of sexual relations between the women and the gods of Yahweh's counsel. And so there's some sort of connection there in terms of the fallen face, but surely if you do right, if you do something right, there is you'll be taken care of. But if you do not do right, then sin couches at the door, and it's personified. Sin's urge is toward you, but still, you can be its master. And so, in other words, it's an encouragement. You can do this. You can do a better job. Give me something better, I would think, than what you're presenting, because what he's presented is an accursed thing, because it came from the ground.
How does it stop ever coming from the ground, though, if that's the key piece?
Dan, that's a great question, and that's where it actually gets very exciting, I think, for our listeners, especially because of its connection with the connection with the answer to the book of Moses that Joseph Smith produces. We have this allusion to a cursed earth, right, in various texts from the book of Moses. Moses 7, we're going to see Enoch talking to God, and he in verse 54, he's so upset because the earth is struggling and the earth has been cursed. Verse 54, I'm in Moses 7 that Joseph Smith produces, and it came to pass that Enoch cried unto the Lord, saying, when the Son of Man cometh in the flesh, shall the earth finally rest? I pray thee, show me these things. And God is going to tell him, yes, the earth will finally get its rest, but the rest and the eradication of the curse to the earth is actually going to transpire at a much earlier stage. And we can see the resolution to that actually in Genesis chapter 8 after the flood story. Noah in chapter 8 at the end is going to leave the ark and he's going to build an altar to Yahweh. And then verse 21, Yahweh is going to smell the pleasing odor that, and he's going to say to himself, never again will I curse the earth because of man. And Yahweh comes to this conclusion that, well, the devisings of man's mind are evil from his youth, and I will never destroy everything like I've done in the past. And he comes to grips with the fact that man is going to be evil. He's going to rebel against what he tells him to do, this creature that he's made. But still, man is worth having around. And one of the reasons he's worth having around is because of the sacrifice that Yahweh enjoys smelling and consuming. It again ties to the Mesopotamian traditions of feeding God through sacrifice. We see that as the resolution of the flood story in the traditions of the ancient Near East that the Yahwist is drawing upon. So ultimately, the curse on the earth is eradicated through the flood and after that. And so that does tie ultimately, I like the way from an LDS theological perspective, we would of course take that with baptism as a symbol to eradicate that curse and then bring the earth into a new world order. And by the way, that's what's happening with the flood, that as we get to that stage, the flood then we have earth, chaos, water, everything that was described in the pre-creative state in Genesis 1, verse 2. So really what the flood is doing is taking us back to primordial chaos so that Yahweh can then start afresh with Noah and the curse that is then removed from the ground that the man causes to be placed upon it by consuming the fruit.
Could we also say that later on when curses are given, it's not because of the violation of Genesis, as most assume. It's for later covenants throughout the Tanakh. And then the last verse of Malachi, where he says, lest I come and, you know, smite the earth with a curse. And, of course, not all Hebrew manuscripts have that little fragment there. But isn't it interesting? There are curses, and then Ezekiel 30 through 33 are cancellations of those curses. So when we hear these preachers get on the radio and say, you know, you're being cursed because of occultism unto the 10th generation, Ezekiel 30 even canceled those written in the books of Moses.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tom. That's because at this stage, then the curse on the earth is completely eradicated. It's very clear textually. And again, I like the way that this is picked up thematically in the LDS book of Moses, Moses 7, verse 48. Again, Enoch looked upon the earth, and he heard a voice from the bowels thereof saying, woe, woe is me, the mother of men. And that's really wonderful to personify the earth as mother. We see that in a variety of ancient Near Eastern traditions. She says, I am pained, I am weary because of the wickedness of my children. When shall I rest and be cleansed from the filthiness which has gone forth out of me? Isn't that interesting, the verbiage? Now, I'm not one that believes that this is a restoration of some of an original text. I believe this is as a Latter-day Saint, I'd interpret the Book of Moses as an inspired expansion upon Genesis, beyond what the original authors ever had intended. But the way that it, from my perspective, Dan, picks up on this idea with the verbiage is so profound and beautiful. When shall I rest and be cleansed from the filthiness which is gone forth out of me? Which is exactly what Cain is offering in Genesis. He's offering the fruit of the ground that is coming out, and it's filthy. It's unacceptable to Yahweh, which is why he rejects it. When will my Creator sanctify me, states the earth, back in Moses 7, that I may rest and righteousness for a season abide upon my face? And when Enoch heard the earth mourn, I'm in verse 49, he wept and cried unto the Lord, saying, O Lord, wilt thou not have compassion on the earth? Wilt thou not bless the children of Noah? And then starts talking about the flood. So there is really a very nice connection in the Book of Moses thematically with a detailed reading of Genesis and what that curse and covenant is all about that Tom's referring to.
Right. And then Enoch, you miss it in Genesis because there's so little on Enoch there versus Joseph's expansion in the Book of Moses. But Enoch is the third named child of Adam and Eve, right? Am I right there?
Yeah.
So this is pretty early on, if you count, you know, this, I guess Enoch was 300-something years old, it says, or something, before the city. Beyond that Yahweh is removing the curse there. But then you get the Noah stuff later, so he has to remove it again. All this is just confusing to me, and I just put it up to ancient text kind of stuff. But
well, do you, as my colleagues, acknowledge, or do you believe that was R.K. Harrison and Hugh Nibley correct when they talk about the colophons? You know, that they were, Genesis 1 through 11 were like histories that were just condensed in a card catalog type of a table of contents, you know, to just mention Lamech or to mention Enosh and just move right on by, like an old card catalog system would have worked. Or do you think scholarship has moved beyond that?
Well, I it seems to me scholarship, to answer the question, has moved beyond that. I would have a hard time viewing this as historically reliable material.
Right.
To be quite frank, but it's more mythology, and that doesn't mean it's not true. It has great truths that can be applied not only to the Yahwist time period, but we can look at it and learn about how he expressed his views regarding his relationship to divinity and humankind's relationship to God and how that connects. And even sometimes I think there's benefit to looking and saying, wait, I don't agree with that. That's different than my view, and both are important for a critical religious thinker. Dan, maybe we should try and eradicate some of that confusion then, because that you mentioned, because it's actually very logical. If we just stick with Genesis, the earth is cursed because of what the man did. Therefore, everything that comes out of the earth, including grain, is an accursed thing, and to present it to Yahweh, it would be offensive, obviously. And that curse remains in Genesis upon the ground until after the flood in Genesis chapter 8, where Yahweh then states very specifically, I love this sacrifice, and now I'm going to take the curse from off of the earth. I just factored in, so it's very logical. I factored in the Enoch material just because it provides an interesting correspondence, and you yourself referred to the fact that Enoch is long before Noah. So here you have this pre Noah figure, this patriarch, stepping forward and talking about in great detail about why the earth is cursed and when is it going to happen. The curse is going to be removed, and ultimately, from Enoch's perspective, in the long term, there'll be some type of curse that remains until the return of the Son of Man. So there is a little bit of a difference we should be aware of, but still, ultimately, it's in my mind, as I suggested, it's picking up on these very subtle yet profound themes that we find in Jay's account.
Well, don't we see clear in the Book of Revelation a covenant lawsuit that echoes from Isaiah, where cursed are those who hurt the earth, and therefore God, even in the end of days, is not happy with that. You know, as the covenant lawsuit is finally issued and justice comes to the world.
Yeah.
All right, so I don't know how much longer we want to stay on you know, this cursed stuff, but it seems to me like Cain is in a big bind, because no matter what he does, he's not going to be able to present anything, because it's going to be cursed at least until after the flood. But maybe he is God in 6 and 7 of verse 4, of, hey, there's a chance that you could really step up here and uncurse this, but you're failing at that. Is that the only redemptive thing that gives Cain? I mean, right now I have a little sympathy for Cain if he's, you know, basically, hey, I was the guy that was ended up tilling the earth, and I didn't know that this was going to be so cursed forever, and there was nothing I can do. God's saying maybe there is something you can do, but you're blowing it when he gets going.
Yeah, I don't think at this stage conceptually there's anything that Cain can do to remove the curse from the stuff that he is producing out of the soil, because it's an accursed thing, because it comes out of the ground that had been cursed in the previous chapter. So there's really nothing he can do from that end. I mean, in theory, he could have, probably what he probably should have done from the author's perspective is that he should have perhaps traded some of that cursed material to his brother Abel and been able to give God a more acceptable kosher sacrifice.
Interesting stuff. Cool. I don't want to get too far with this. Tom, in between our recording sessions, you mentioned that we ought to went something that we've completely left out, and that is, you know, in the day thou shalt eat, thou shalt surely die. And somewhere along the line, let's just loop back, and I think now's the right time before we go too much further, to the meaning of the word yom, day, and then how this day thou shalt eat, you shall surely die, when clearly they're living hundreds of years longer and all that stuff. So
exactly.
Okay, let me finish off. Sorry, I don't know how.
Okay, sorry.
If we can factor this in before we move on, because I'm really excited to hear what Tom has to say on that, and we've been looking forward to that in our off the air conversations. But I think just to tie this up, remember after then Cain kills Abel in verse 10, God says, "Well, what have you done? Look, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Therefore, you, Cain, because you're a murderer, you're going to be even more cursed than the ground. The ground that you were harvesting and producing these accursed things, you're even more cursed now because you've done this thing and your brother's blood has seeped into the earth, and it has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. So you now are even more cursed than the earth," is what it specifically states, because you're a murderer. So, anyway, I think
yeah,
that's
interesting stuff. Yeah.
Very clear context, isn't it, Brother David put it in?
Yeah, I think that's the natural conclusion then to where we're going with that. And so anyway, I wanted to make sure we got that in there. But yes, on to Tom's great insights and observations.
Many conservative commentators erroneously try to, you know, place Genesis into a literal historical documentary type of history. And so they seem to take passages that evening and morning, you know, became the first day. And they don't give a lot of credence to the idea that we're reading either a temple text or we're reading a cosmological text that is made to paint pictures with literary worship. And we go into the Hebrew lectionary readings in the Siddur. Genesis 2:3 begins, you know, the Friday night readings that lead us into Sabbath, which is still part of my Christian tradition. And God hallowed and blessed the Sabbath and so on. And they try to, you know, make a linear time sweep about, you know, when did these creative acts of God actually happen? And they try to use the word yom, but it's only a 24-hour application, you know, to it, and God had to do everything within 7 24-hour days because Jesus said, aren't there, you know, 12 hours in night, and aren't there 12 hours in a day, and, you know, and many things are taken out of context. By the time we get to the writing of the Babylonian Talmud, we know that the word yom had many different meanings to it. And I think we can see it contextually as well. By the time of the first revision of the Hebrew calendar was done, we definitely see yom also had calendrical type of applications that the rabbis would apply to it. Here are some of them. You had a lunar day. You had a solar day. You had a lunar-solar day compilation to bring your Hebrew calendar into line from the 354 point blah, 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 solar and lunar days. You had to bring it into conformity, and they developed laws of postponement, et cetera, et cetera. So there were creative days where God just did things. One of my professors from Claremont, Dr. Charles Dorothy, said we really need to read this, and it made a lot of sense to me when I heard it, in literary fashion, as sort of Act 1, Day 2, Scene 2, Day 3. You know, in other words, it's like we're in the temple, as Sorensen points out, and we're going through the liturgical readings that begin the new year on Friday night with the Sabbath, and these things are reconstructed in Templar and symbolic stories. And then you can have a 24-hour day, but it's not limited to that. You also have a prophetic day. In the day you eat thereof, or the day your eyes are opened, or the day the curse begins, or, you know, in the Old Testament we see after many days, you know. And so for anyone to try and suggest that it's limited to a 24-hour day, in my opinion, is not paying close attention to the data.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Feedback, comments, because this is something we'll have to answer, you know, to, you know, the fundamentalist when they bring, you know, the literalness, you know, of the days up.
Cool.
I love the way that Tom frames that and expresses that. I think it's very helpful to our listeners who are Latter-day Saint and believers in light of the things that we've talked about, because when we take an academic and scholarly approach to this and understand the text from an historical critical perspective, it causes some paradigm shifts. And yet, I think that we can still acknowledge this, take a look at it, and even accept some of these observations, and yet still find spiritual meaning and inspiration in what these documents present. And I guess I'll pick up specifically on what Tom said in terms of the temple imagery. Going back to what I suggested, I don't see the Book of Moses as a restoration of something that Moses literally wrote, or a text that existed at some point in the ancient Near East that Joseph Smith then produced. I see it doing something else entirely. It changes, from my perspective, the Sitzenleben. There's a technical term that scholars use to refer to the setting in life, or the way we understand and read a document contextually. It changes the Sitzenleben and gives us a new way of looking at the opening chapters of Genesis. So the Book of Moses takes the creation, the fall narrative, it elaborates on sacrifice, the identification of true witnesses. It does all of this, these wonderful things that it extracts out of the opening chapters of Genesis, and places it specifically into the context of a revelation that Moses receives on not just a mountain, not just a high mountain, but textually an exceedingly high mountain, which connects heaven and earth, and therefore it takes it and puts it into the context of temple revelation. And so it now, as we approach this, it gives us a chance to do things like literally put ourselves in the place as if we are Adam and if we are Eve, and draw principles out and try to understand our relationship to divinity, and certainly for Latter-day Saints, temple covenants and everything else that is important to us in terms of our ritual worship. So I love the way that Tom frames that. I think it works well for an LDS audience.
Awesome. Definitely great stuff. Anything else, Tom, on the loop back there? Because otherwise I want to go to the cursing of Cain.
Well, I would love to add, there's a wonderful book out there that anyone who would love to study myth from a scriptural standpoint and how it can be used to aid us in the revelation of God is written by Gary Dorian, and it's called The Word as True Myth. and where he compares it to a lot of the Sumerian and other texts and the Persians and their view of creation and wisdom and the tree of knowledge, blah, 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 and tries to draw from all of the sources what scripture is trying to zero in and what our communities can actually pull from it. In the larger light that the Sitzenleben, as Von Rod and Brother David so eloquently described as the real setting in life. And isn't it something? I found this out. The closer I grow to the setting in life, the more sense scripture actually makes to me. Because I think what happens is we only interpret and read the verses that resonate with our own thinking, as Hugh Nibley used to say. You know, so it just ends up as James Sanders, you know, said Claremont so often, well, it's a canon within the canon, and then we have actually false readings and false conclusions that come out of this because we're not dealing with its original setting. So I think seeing the Bible as true myth and what it's trying to really tell our communities for wisdom and experience and other enlightenment issues is really the way to go.
I'm with you there, brother. And just, again, true has so many different meanings other than factually this is what happened or factually.
Precisely.
Correspondence theory of truth. There's all those other types of truth. Awesome. Thank you very much. Anything else on any of that, David? Or otherwise, let's go to this strange cursing of Cain.
No, I think Tom summed it up very nicely. I love his approach to scripture and to myth. I think that we as Latter-day Saints can benefit from what he's suggesting without question. So picking up then where I left off, yeah, chapter 4, verse 9, the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" And he said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And that's another nice play, right? Because what is Abel? He's a keeper of sheep. So,
oh, okay.
You know, so here's, am I my brother's keeper? So it's this great play. And then he said, "Well, what have you done? Hark. Or look, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Therefore, you shall be more cursed than the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. So if you toil the soil," now verse 12, "it shall no longer yield its strength to you. You shall become a ceaseless wanderer on the earth." So all these, so here we have an extension. Just like Yahweh gave curses to Cain's parents, now he's giving a curse to Cain, the child. "And Cain said to the Lord, Yahweh, my punishment is too great to bear since you have banished me this day from the soil." And that's how he makes his living. It's what he does. "I must avoid your presence and become a restless wanderer on the earth. Anyone who meets me is going to kill me." And Yahweh says to him, "Well, I promise if anyone kills Cain, sevenfold vengeance shall be taken on him." And Yahweh put a mark on Cain lest anyone who met him should kill him. And then he goes off and leaves the presence of Yahweh and goes and settles in Nod in the east of Eden text. So poor Cain, you feel sorry for him. You're right, Dan, at the initial level. And yet he becomes so angry that he takes his brother's life. And this is our first account of murder, how it enters into the world, and which is such a terrible thing. And the curse follows him. And boy, don't we know that that has been interpreted in such a damaging way by so many theologians, including LDS thinkers as well, but no reference to skin and things like that.
No, some have suggested it could have been war paint, headdresses, and type of gather hunters or whoever would see him would automatically know what he was.
Yeah.
So absolutely, the J. Rider, he gives no hints. There's nothing from other tales that you think he's drawing on in this case that would give us a hint that it would be something other. You know, in other words, you guys are saying, well, the black stuff is just one out of many possible interpretations, but is there anything that would hint and lean towards something different?
I don't see any. That terrible tradition is certainly not part of the text itself. It's just not there.
Okay. So somehow or other, Cain is going to get to live. And then, have I screwed up earlier when I said Enoch is born of Adam and Eve as the third named child? When here, at verse 17, it looks like it's Cain and his wife that are the parents of Enoch.
This is a different Enoch.
Oh, okay. Well, because it says that he built a city.
Yeah. this is a different Enoch, and it's
the Enoch that's in the listing versus the one who built the city.
Yeah.
Okay, and so we're confusing it because we have this big emphasis on he built, you know, a perfected community that was taken up in...
No. That's different. This is a different Enoch.
Okay, thank you. Helps me, because all of a sudden I'm seeing this.
And the writings of Enoch were over a millennia later.
Yeah. They're going to be picked up in chapter... That Enoch that you're referring to, Dan, which is the one that we read about in the Book of Moses, he's going to be identified in chapter 5, and he's going to...
Okay.
Which is actually a different source tradition.
Oh, it's not J?
No, not chapter 5. Chapter 5 links with chapter 1. So though that's part of the priestly account. And it actually is really beautiful the way that it connects if readers want to check this out. Because remember, Genesis 1 through 2, 4a, that's the priestly story of creation we discussed in the first podcast. And the conclusion there is through inclusio, remember, these are the generations of the heaven and earth when they were created. Then the narrative for P begins in chapter 5, verse 1. It's a logical transition. This is the scroll of Adam. And for the first time now, we have Adam as a human being, Adam as a proper noun.
For the first time, okay.
Yeah, this is no longer is Adam, you know, just a general term for humankind. So now Adam is the Adam that we know as a person. This is his story. So that it's a beautiful transition. It works very smoothly, and it's one of the arguments in favor that we're dealing with documentary traditions rather than fragmentary supplements.
Yeah, and it would make sense that a priestly writer, somebody with priestly concerns, which are these, you know, everything from things being in the right order and purity and all those different things that he does, to make sure we got the records kept on, here's the generations and et cetera.
That's exactly right. Not all of them, because Jade certainly has some genealogy records, but a lot of the lengthy and, from our perspective as readers, boring genealogy.
Right.
Right. Those are part of the priestly tradition. They're very concerned about the heritage and making sure that so-and-so is the son of so-and-so all the way back, because it has priesthood implications. So it does make sense from their tradition. But the other thing we see is that in the same way, Dan, that the priests were very concerned with maintaining cultic and ritual boundaries, distinguishing between that which was pure versus that which was impure, and having all these things. We see very clear textual boundaries. It's the same type of mindset that would see the world in terms of clean versus unclean, wants to make rigid distinctions in the text. And so all of those phrases that our readers will encounter in the King James Bible, these are the generations of Adam, these are the generations of Enoch, these are the generations of Noah, these are the generations of Abraham, and so forth. Those are all part of this priestly narrative, and it's one of the ways of seeing how this particular source structures its tale of prehistory and how that originally develops into the historical era of the priestly author.
Some also suggest, such as J.B. Lightfoot, that also the number of entries are symbolically important. You know, it's like we know there were not 14 generations, you know, from the first man to Abraham to Jesus. David, have you looked much into that, to the symbolic nature of what is contained in the amount of entries?
You know, there seems to be something there is going on. It's hard for me to put my finger on it, Tom, but I do. One of the things that is interesting, I guess, for an LDS audience, and I think there definitely is some legitimacy to, I don't know how much time we have to explore it, but there's something that there was an Israeli scholar by the name of Yair Zakovich who wrote his dissertation in 1977, I want to say, the Hebrew University of Israel, on what he referred to as the 3-4 pattern. And he illustrated that quite frequently in Israelite storytelling, we'll have a sequence of three events, and then the fourth one will be the most climactic moment of all, will resolve the conflict or issues that happened in the previous three attempts. And so there's this literary pattern that he identifies time and time again, and then he shows, it's interesting, it actually appears and is taken and adopted into the laws as well. So you'll see, for example, the statement in Exodus chapter 20 that God will punish, the punishment will last for the rebellious generation to the third and then to the fourth resolution, the fourth generation. And what Zakovich showed very clearly is that in a lot of the genealogy list, that we'll see that sometimes the historian will fudge information to get someone very important into position 4.
We see that
happening not only in the priestly lines that they talk about, but it's really great. You'll see it, for example, well, in Genesis chapter 49 when we get to the patriarchal blessings, right? So that the curse that is placed on the first three sons of Israel, right, prepare for the fourth one to receive all homage from his brother, and that's Judah, the line of Judah.
Some people feel in parallelisms that happens too, you know, on the fourth reference, like it's the greatest, you know, of the other three.
Yeah. I love to show this to students in terms of the story of David, once we get to 1 Samuel, because, you know, here you have Jesse's sons. He has seven sons that pass in front of Samuel, and only the first three are named. You have to ask yourself, why would the narrator bother to name the first three and then just say, and then all of the rest passed in front of it? Well, it's because then the fourth son of Jesse that will be named will actually be David. So these were some of the observations that Zakovich made in his dissertation. And I think there is some legitimacy, definitely, to these sorts of trends. And by the way, I'll just interject and say I've always found it very interesting that if you're reading the Book of Mormon as an ancient Near Eastern text and you came across all of a sudden this political narrative that's justifying Nephi's kingship, you would read that and read, you know, that in the same way that the brothers get together and cast lots, and it just so happens that the lot falls upon the eldest brother, Laman, and gives him a chance to go forward and try to show his position of hierarchy in the family and the right of primogeniture, because, of course, they don't believe in the idea of chance. God is in control of everything. They would look at that and say, my goodness, Nephi is the fourth son. And the light bulb would go off, and they'd say, my goodness, he's going to be someone special. We ought to watch out for him because he's the fourth one named in the text. So, you know, Tom, I don't know how much to make of all of this, but I'm with you. There definitely has to be some symbolic meaning to the way that, you know, names are given in the order and the structure.
Some say 14, you know, starts the priestly tradition, you know, and to show the beginning and the purity of the line. Don't know if it always works, but it does take some of the tension out of the inerrancy model, doesn't it? They're trying to make them all line up.
It does. I would encourage our listeners to exercise a bit of caution, because we're starting to get into this realm of numerology, and numerology is sometimes taken and used with, you know, considerable emphasis in terms of the Hebrew Bible, and with a bit of you know, it's something that definitely develops later in Jewish tradition. It's going to become very important in the Christian era, certainly with the Book of Revelation, but it's really hard historically to see that numerology existing at the time that these biblical sources were being produced. So, yes, there's something there, but it's easy then, and oftentimes commentators do.
Awesome, guys. Well, yeah, and all that stuff to me, just, again, it just helps me know these are not contemporaries of mine. They live in different worlds. They have their own purposes and things like that. And then it just gives me that chance to enjoy a richer version of somebody else. Like you say, David, their encounters with God, many insights, all sorts of things there that now jump out for me without the pressure of aligning them with actual factual, you know, factually reliable stuff and all that. I love even this last little burst. So, even that took us away from the text. Anything else in the text, guys? This is where we kind of said, let's end our, you know, it'll end up being four episodes for this first chunk on the Bible. Is there anything in this first four chapters of Genesis that either of you want to say, or do you want to re-emphasize anything before we head out?
I really would just love our audience to pay attention in how to mine the nuggets out of it. When we say something is myth, it does not mean it isn't true or has a method within itself to convey truths to us. If we talk about priestly reconstructions of poetry and possibly numerology, we're not saying to everybody to go out and get a Kabbalah, you know, and go down the Hollywood numbers game, but just to understand these things help us in understanding, I think, the revelations in fuller and more accurate detail. We don't want to go down, which some have, a completely deconstructive mode, which some of the mainline churches did in the 1950s. The reason for this is then you have your congregations who don't have always the training, even though they're very intelligent people and they've been trained in other professions. They look at things and they just begin to draw their own conclusions. Well, number one, there is no truth in myth because it's all story. And we've been trying to convey the power of myth, as Joseph Campbell describes it, that sometimes it's even more powerful and more effective than trying to literally, inerrantly line these things up in ways they were not meant to be cross-pollinated. We're trying to say to our prospective faith communities that it will make our faith more real, more challenging, as we struggle to understand the tensions within the text. As Sanders used to say, that's how we really grow as people. The problem is our faith communities tend to think, well, I just read it, and I'm already there. Okay, we've read this text 1,000 times, you know, about the two evils and or the two good ways or whatever, or is it 24-hour days, you know, and they just go through it saying the same thing over and over. If we want to learn to dig deeper and ask ourselves, well, what is the wisdom that's being talked about? Then we can look at Jeremiah, you know, 1, 4, and 5, before I formed thee in thy belly, I knew thee. And then we can ask ourselves, well, you know, does that term yada, you know, actually begin to show us that God is developing the interfacing of his B'nai Elohim as his sons and daughters, as his plan, you know, opens up to us, and someday we'll climb Zion's holy hill. Someday we'll go up to the final embrace, the final enthronement, and have all wisdom and all knowledge. And I really feel these are things Scripture is trying to give to us if we have the ears to hear.
Thank you so much. David, any final thought from you or comment on Tom?
Yeah, no, it's very eloquently stated, and I totally agree with Tom. I guess maybe a final observation on this would be that, you know, in terms of source criticism, we see at the end of chapter 4 this allusion to, it was at verse 26, a reference to the fact that it was at that point after Cain that men began to invoke Yahweh by name. So the name Yahweh is revealed very early on in human history, according to this documentary tradition, which stands in direct contrast to what we see in Genesis chapter 1, and then the narrative it picks up in 5, where Yahweh is never mentioned. It's only Elohim, translated as God in the King James translation. And that's very much the case for this documentary whole that we have identified as a priestly narrative. Yahweh is never mentioned by name ever in the text, either by the narrator or by any of the characters, until we reach actually the book of Exodus. P extends all the way into Exodus. It actually probably concludes with the final chapter of Deuteronomy. But it's in Exodus chapter 6 within P that Moses on the mountain asks God, well, what is your name? And then in verse 3, God says to Moses, well, I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of Elohim. Well, actually, El Shaddai, God Almighty, which is actually it's wonderful. If we go back into the patriarchal narratives that we find in what source critics identify as P, sure enough, all of the patriarchs are referring to deity by the term El Shaddai, God Almighty. But then he states, but by my name Jehovah, I was not known to them, by my name Yahweh. And so this is the first time where then Yahweh makes known his name beyond Elohim. And it then brings the traditions together that we're finding in ancient Israel. So I would just say that, you know, there's a, boy, when we start to, I guess going back to what I mentioned a broadcast or two ago, I don't remember which episode it will be in, but I mentioned that I was told by some very well-meaning professors that I interacted with who were believing Latter-day Saints that I should not study these types of things, that it would be very difficult for me. And I made the statement, famous last words, I'll never buy into anything like the documentary hypothesis. Right?
Yep.
And
yep.
It took about probably less than two months of dealing with these issues for the first time ever that I realized that if I was going to take the text seriously, I needed to allow for the attestation of various sources. And it was very difficult because I'd been kind of brought up intellectually to think that I couldn't reconcile my religiosity with historical criticism. And I'll just say that it is challenging, it is difficult, it certainly requires shifting paradigms and breaks down some traditional assumptions, but again, I guess I take I put a lot of weight into the Prophet Joseph's perspective that we should try to seek for that which is true, and if there is truth out there that causes us to look at the development of Scripture differently than we traditionally assumed, then that truth is fundamental to Mormonism. Mormonism is a philosophy, states Joseph Smith, that seeks to embrace all truth, let it come from where it may. And if it comes from source criticism, if it comes from historical analysis, if it comes from scientific observations, we bring that into Mormonism and we use that to help us understand our relationship with divinity. And I feel good about that. It's a fundamental part of my approach to being a Latter-day Saint now.
Dude, your perspectives have meant a lot here, and thank you for always sharing your personal stuff here. Has been so important, so I really appreciate that, David.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the opportunity, Dan, because I think it's important to be able to take that approach. And I am grateful for Tom, and we said this off the air last time, but you know, Tom illustrates a tradition that has a lot in common with how Mormons view deity, how we view apotheosis, and humans becoming gods. And yet here's not only Tom himself, but he comes from a tradition that's been dealing with these sorts of issues a lot longer than we have as Latter-day Saints. So I think this is a chance for us to learn from Tom and his tradition and you know, can help us as we try to make sense of all these things. So very grateful for what he shared.
Me too. Wow. Thank you again.
Well, isn't that interesting? As we all grow, we all become, you know, deeper enriched, and our faith walk becomes more valuable to us, not less than.
Sweet. Very wise.
And now I'll just say, we have to come back at some point and do the B'nai HaElohim and talk about how they have sexual intercourse with the women in preparation for the flood, because that's an exciting text.
Well, dudes, thank you so much. I appreciate that tease, David, to the flood narrative. That'll be where we'll start the next time we reconvene. But you guys have been so generous with your time over three different days and probably about 6 hours total time. So I just, what great friends, what great hearts, what amazing minds and study. You guys are just, you've blown my mind many, many times during this. And I'm sure our listeners are really, really appreciate it. So thank you very much, guys.
Well, you're more than welcome, Dan. I feel it's such a privilege to share with such great colleagues and brethren in the faith. And I really think it does show us that God's love and his redemption goes beyond the denominational boundaries.
Grateful for a chance to share things that I'm so passionate about. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Listeners, jump in, ask questions at the website. While you're there, donate to the podcast, please, please, please. It really, really helps. And we will just reconvene with these particular friends another time, three or four podcasts from now. And we'll kind of pick it up and make this a series. So, again, good night, everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David and Dan.
Thank you, Tom. This was great.
Absolutely marvelous.
All right, cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
To use better far for us. control.